Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Rock Review. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about rock and roll music from such sources as the News and Observer, The Week magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly.
Something's got me reeling, stop me from believing, turn me around again.
This opening number, Every Morning, brought to us by a group called Sugar Ray. We'll be hearing more about Sugar Ray later on in today's program, and Sugar Ray will close it out as well. But first, these trivia questions. Today's trivia questions come to us from www.funtrivia.com. Question number one, who sang the song Spooky? Hint, this song reached number three back in 1968. Question number two, fill in the blank. This is a song title. Help Me Blank. Hint, the title of a 1965 song was performed by this group.
Aruba, Jamaica, ooh, I wanna take ya. Bermuda, Bahama, come on, pretty mama. Key Largo, Montego, baby, why don't we go? Jamaica, off the Florida Keys.
You should know this group. What's the name of the song? Help Me Blank. What goes into that blank? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. The transition section of today's program is brought to us by BGORecords.com. From their series Today in Rock History, and today is the weekend of April 29th. What were the number one hits this weekend? Well, back in 1966, you may remember, it was the Young Rascals at number one with Good Lovin'. And back in 1972, it was Roberta Flack with First Take at number one. And on this weekend, back in 1978, it was the Bee Gees with Night Fever, Disco Times. Back in 1983, it was Michael Jackson with Beat It at number one this weekend. If you were born on April 29, you share a B-Day with Duke Ellington. He was born on April 29, 1899. Also, Klaus Voormann was born on April 29. He's from Manfred Mann. He was born on that day back in 1942. And Tommy James, of Tommy James and the Shondells, Crimson and Clover, he was born on April 29, 1947. And Carney Wilson, from Wilson Phillips, she was born on that day, April 29, 1968. Or if you were born on April 30th, you share a B-Day with Johnny Horton, Battle of New Orleans, born on that day, April 30th, 1927. Willie Nelson was also born on April 30th, 1933. And Bobby V, Take Good Care of My Baby, born on April 30th, 1943. Miscellany in rock history this weekend. Well, back in 1964, the Beatles receive $140,000 for the sale of brand name bubblegum in the USA. And back in 1967 this weekend, it was Aretha Franklin's Respect released. And back in 1972, John Lindsay, the mayor of New York, makes a personal plea to U.S. immigration authorities to deport John Lennon and Yoko Ono. And back in 1992, 20 years after that this weekend, it was Madonna's Bustiere is stolen from Fredericks of Hollywood, while L.A. is gripped by rioting and looting following the Rodney King verdict. A $1,000 reward is offered for the Bustiere's return.
We are the crowd. We're cooking on the toast. Got me cash on the street.
This next story is brought to us by David Menconi, News and Observer, on the 11th of March, 2011, entitled, Making a Lot from a Little. Give a listen to Civilian, Merge Records, the new album from Y Oak, that's spelled W-Y-E, and it might seem like the work of a very large ensemble. The album's dreamy sound feels expansive enough to dive into, with ample sonic nooks and crannies. It's one of those records that yields newly noticed detail with every listen. But if you went to the group's Chapel Hill show in March, you would have noticed that Y Oak is just two people. There's Jen Wozner, who sings, writes lyrics, and plays guitar, and Andy Stack, who basically does everything else. Of necessity, the live versions of the songs are paired from their studio incarnations, yet they come closer to replicating their studio sound on stage than you might think they could. By the limitation of our setup, the live and studio arrangements do not end up drastically different, Stack says, by phone from the band's hometown of Baltimore. A lot of being in the studio is letting arrangements present themselves to us. In the past, that meant piling on more and more stuff because we want to be this big, noisy band, even though there's just two of us. There's some of that on this record, but mostly it's an exercise in restraint. At the same time, we've gotten to where there's more complexity to the live arrangements, he adds. We incorporate samples, some different electronic elements, to get sounds that previously seemed unattainable just because of sheer mathematics, the number of limbs we have. We've toured so much the last few years, we're much more comfortable and there's less discrepancy between recorded and live versions, but it's still a different experience. The point is, the song should stand up to whatever interpretation you throw at it. It was interesting to see how the coldly beautiful ambiance of Civilian translated live. Between the atmospheric sound and Wozner's dusky voice, the vibe is distant and lonely. The closing track, Doubt, concludes, I believe it then, believe it still. Professing a belief in doubt does not seem like the height of lyrical ambivalence. Ambivalence is this record's emotional context, and it's a thread that runs through everything we've made, Stack says. There's the idea that a person exists in several emotional spaces simultaneously and feels conflicted by trying to contextualize life within that space. The most overused way to put it would be melancholic. But the extremes of joy, sadness, loneliness, they don't exist separately from each other. There may be much more correlated than you'd think. So musically, none of these songs are entirely lonely, and none are entirely joyful. There's always a combination thereof. That's a lot to have going on in a song, and it requires an adroit balancing act. That seems especially true when there are only two people trying to keep everything in the air. Do they ever think about expanding the lineup? Not really, Stack says. Jen and I have been playing together in this group and also a half dozen other bands, so we already work together in a lot of different contexts. Y Oak is the two of us, and getting other people involved would make it a different band. Never say never, but I still feel challenged by it in a productive way as we work on unlocking this puzzle. Our mantra has always been, if we ever feel like it's not engaging us anymore, we'll bring in others and try other projects. We still feel like there's lots of creative energy to get out. This next article comes to us from L. Gordon Krovitz, Wall Street Journal, published on the 22nd of November, 2010, entitled, Phonograph CD MP3, What's Next? I am particularly glad to no one longer being asked when the Beatles are coming to iTunes, said Ringo Starr recently, as the 5-4's record company finally agreed to have their music sold through digital downloads by Apple. This agreement could mark the beginning of the end of the digital dislocation of the music industry, the first industry to be completely disrupted by information age technology. Apple CEO Steve Jobs said, "It has been a long and winding road to get here," understating the case. Members of the band and other rights holders had long objected to Apple's practice of selling songs separately from albums, disagreed with its pricing, and feared illegal file sharing of the songs if they were ever made available online. Article skips down. Music has been a test case for technology transitions before. In the 19th century, the sheet music publishers of Tin Pan Alley dominated the industry, but were disrupted by recorded sound when Thomas Edison invented the phonograph. This was, in turn, replaced by newer physical forms of recordings, from 8-track tapes to cassettes and CDs. In the Internet era, sales of albums, bundles of music, broke down as consumers downloaded just the songs they wanted, usually illegally. The iTunes Store, launched in 2003, popularized legal downloads. Streaming music online has also become popular. Today, 1/4 of recorded music revenue comes from digital channels. This tells us that technology can reward both creators and consumers, even as traditional middlemen, such as record companies, get squeezed. The article skips down. Several years ago, the big legal battle featured music industry companies suing some 35,000 people who illegally downloaded songs. Piracy continues, but now the industry is instead looking for new revenue streams. Sean Parker, the founder of the original downloading service Napster, has advice for music companies. "The war on piracy is a failure," he says. "Labels must offer services that consumers are willing to pay for, focusing on convenience and accessibility." Some musicians still hold out against digital downloads. Country star Kid Rock explained to Billboard magazine recently why he stays off of iTunes. "I have trouble with the way iTunes says everybody's music is worth the same price. I don't think that's right. There's music out there that's not a penny. They should be giving it away, or they should be making the artist pay people to listen to it." Still, there are encouraging signs that creators and distributors are coming together. Artists often skip the music industry altogether by using new technology to make songs cheaply, then market them on the web. For many musicians, the real money comes from concerts and merchandisings. For bands that appeal to older audiences, such as the Beatles, CD sales remain brisk. For music and many content-based industries, the shift to the information age from the industrial age is a shift to digital versions from older analog versions. Article skips down and ends with this. If the music industry can learn new tricks, there's hope for all the other industries that are being transformed as technology continues to give consumers more choices. The best alternative for smart industries is to take the advice of the Beatles song, "Let It Be." Make the most of technological progress and recognize that certain things are beyond anyone's control. This next article is brought to us by Daily Variety, published on the 31st of March, 2011, in Variety.com. It's a film review of a film called Abraxas from Japan. Abraxas sports more than enough novelty just by allowing its hero the contradictions inherent in being a Buddhist monk by day and a punk rocker by night. Naoki Kaito's gently appealing serio-comedy treats mental illness and key Buddhist concepts, mostly involving mortality, with the same wry respect. Playing the Fest circuit after the Sundance premiere, Pick might gain modest offshore theatrical and disc exposure. We first see protagonist Jonin in an old Tokyo club concert video in which he's the berserk frontman of a thrash band, screaming, shirtless, writhing on the floor, crashing into fellow musicians, and at one point simply stopping cold, as if no longer sure who he is or why he's there. But that was years ago. Now his hair is shorn and his robes stay on, as Jonin has become a monk at the temple in the Fukushima prefecture. But he remains a troubled soul, as evidenced when his talk to a high school group starts out incoherently, then turns into a wild rant. This incident sets local gossips into overdrive, worrying Jonin that perhaps he's not cut out for this role. Article skips down. Jonin has an epiphany. What's caused his recent unsettled state is the lack of music making. Tae fears reopening that can of worms, but Asako and Jen Shu are enthusiastic, though Jen Shu privately feels when his junior monk decides he'll stage a concert and not at his own Tokyo haunts, a little concerned, but right here in the temple's surrounding village. Despite a few improbabilities, the film's low-key progress is ingratiating, and its unshowy presentation nonetheless manages to capture the natural beauty of the region that is the current locus of Japan's post-earthquake tsunami nuclear crisis. Adapting Buddhist monk Sokuyu Kenyu's novel in his first professional feature, Helmer co-scenarist Kato demonstrates a sure touch with pacing, atmosphere, and astutely cast actors. So what do you know about today's featured rock group, Sugar Ray? Well, according to these articles from www.kidsworld.com, Wikipedia, and Amazon.com, Sugar Ray is best known for their pop reggae hit Fly and hot lead singer Mark McGrath. Before they changed their name, they were known as Shrinky Dinks. Remember those plastic toys that you could bake in the oven to make stained glass? They had to change their quirky name because the toy company, Milton Bradley, threatened them with a lawsuit. They chose the name Sugar Ray because they all admired the boxer, Sugar Ray Leonard.
When it's over, that's the time I fall in love.
The guys from California had dreams of becoming rock and roll stars, but like most peeps in the biz, things didn't happen overnight. Mark McGrath worked as a truck driver, the bass player was a pizza chef, the drummer was a paralegal, and the guitarist was a telemarketer. Atlantic Records saw a video which featured their song Caboose and offered them a contract. In 1995, Sugar Ray released their first CD entitled Lemonade and Brownies. Like the combination of Lemonade and Brownies, the album didn't go over very well. But the good thing was that they got to tour with the Sex Pistols, Korn, and Cypress Hill. The producer for the group Sublime helped Sugar Ray produce the highly successful album Floored in 1997. This album sold more than 2 million copies. A big reason for the album's success was the reggae-ish tune Fly. Fly was Sugar Ray's first mainstream hit. The song is now playing in the background. This song was notable for not sounding anything at all like the rest of the tracks on the album and received frequent radio play, resulting in a number one rank on Billboard's Hot 100 list. The album was certified double platinum. However, by the end of 1997, critics were skeptical that Sugar Ray could put out another successful song, and they were labeled as a one-hit wonder. The group, however, has released a total of 7 albums between 1995 and 2009. In 1997, the band was featured in the movie Father's Day, starring Billy Crystal and Robin Williams. Sugar Ray also performed here in Raleigh with Stevie Wonder in the 1990s for the Special Olympics. On the 7 albums produced by this group between 1995 and 2000, their self-titled 4th album received the following review. The frat boy rockers are back, but they're not lining up for tequila shots and pitchers anymore. In fact, they seem to need a little tea and symphony. Heartbreak makes for some absorbing songs in this album and has added some needed grit to the band's once sun-kissed lives. Gone are the boozy nights on the beach and breezy odes to women they've loved and left.
Check it out.
Instant Karma has come home to roost, and Mark McGrath is not only in psychic pain, but he's awfully contrite. Ours, the song that's playing in the background now, is a soap opera with old-school soul leanings that could make the Chi-Lites weep with envy. The band have not abandoned their white guy reggae leanings, but it's now done with a defter touch. Lead singer Mark McGrath's personal popularity soared as he appeared on national magazine covers such as Rolling Stone and Spin. He also made numerous appearances on MTV and VH1 and various talk and award show. People magazine named him the sexiest rocker of 1998.
Hey, Mark.
Yeah?
I'm having a party. Want to come?
Nah, I don't think so, baby.
Oh, come on. It's going to be lots of fun.
Yeah?
In 2004, he recorded a duet with country music singer Shania Twain for her song Party of Two, which is playing in the background now. A country music version of the song was also recorded and released with country music singer Billy Currington. McGrath began his work as co-host of The Extra TV show in 2004 after a producer had noticed his work on MTV. McGrath left the show in 2008 to focus on his music career. He has also served as a guest judge for American Idol auditions that were aired in the year 2005. This next article comes to us from Ed Condren, News and Observer, published on the 18th of February, 2011. For rocking Bon Jovi, midlife is no crisis. F. Scott Fitzgerald once said there are no second acts in American lives. Apparently, the late author never foresaw Bon Jovi. During the 80s, the New Jersey pop rockers went through the stratosphere courtesy of a bunch of catchy cuts, such as Living on a Prayer, You Give Love a Bad Name, and Bad Medicine. Just as grunge hit in 1991, Bon Jovi took a hiatus. The band released a pair of albums during the 90s but kept a relatively low profile during the Clinton era. Yet when the band reunited in 2000, Bon Jovi came out bigger than ever. The songs It's My Life and Who Says You Can't Go Home helped buoy the band back to the upper echelon of pop. These days, Bon Jovi, who performed at the RBC Center earlier this year, is hotter than ever, selling out stadiums and having sold more than 120 million albums. Article skips down. Bon Jovi hopes to write and record many new records and tour in perpetuity. We want to be the Rolling Stones, Sambora says. I know I do. Well, if that's the case, expect to see Sambora and his bandmates, vocalist-guitarist John Bon Jovi, keyboardist David Bryan, and drummer Tico Torres, to be rocking in the year 2033, when, like the Stones, who are planning a tour for 2012, the band will mark a half-century together. This next article comes to us from the Summer Movie Double Issue, Entertainment Weekly, 2011. TV ads that rock. Unidentifiable tune in a commercial driving you crazy? We tell you who's behind it and where to get it. This is by Leah Greenblatt. Their purpose, of course, is to sell you smartphones, cars, and musky body sprays. But many of the commercials currently airing have a happy unintended side effect. They sell you on new and sometimes very old music. Read on to get the score. Trident Gum. This is Martin Solveig and Dragonette. Hello. French DJ Solveig and his Canadian glam pop guest soundtrack Fruit-Based Fun Times. Strawberry Swing Set. Citrus Food Fight. With their shimmery electro celebration, she gives us a B+. Where to find the songs? Well, it's available as a single on iTunes or Amazon. For Ford Fiesta, Edward Sharp and the Magnetic Zeros singing Jangling. The push of a key-free ignition button triggers a carnival of unicycling and giddy street parkour. Set to Sharp's blithe gypsy folk ramble, she gives us a B. And finally, Axe Shower Gel, Brenda and the Tabulations singing The Wash. Bikini bunnies are compelled to follow almost every move of a doofy guy showering beachside. Or maybe they're just bewitched by the sweet command of Brenda's lost Philly soul gem. Given an A, where to find the song? Well, it's on 1967's Dry Your Eyes album. So how'd you do on those trivia questions today? First question asked about who was a group that wrote and sang the 1967 song Spooky? That was the Classic Four. But this group is more of a one-hit wonder than a classic band. And answer number two, the name of this 1965 song is called Help Me, Rhonda, and it's written by Brian Wilson and Mike Love of the Beach Boys. We've run out of time for today's episode of Rock Review. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Content of this program intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. If you have a suggestion for an artist, group, or genre of rock music to feature on Rock Review, please leave a message for me, Randy Thompson, at 832-5138. So long until next time.